chant. Slaver, Shallan said, standing up and pushing her hair back from her face.
As I said, a merchant.
His two guards watched her as they loaded equipment onto the lead wagon. She did not miss the cudgels they carried prominently at their waists. She'd had a sphere in her hand as she walked last night, hadn't she? Memories of that made her feet flare up again. She had to grit her teeth against the agony as pain spren, like orange hands made of sinew, clawed out of the ground nearby. She'd need to clean her wounds, but bloodied and bruised as they were, she wasn't going to be walking anywhere any time soon. Those wagons had seats. They likely stole the sphere from me, she thought. She felt around in her safe pouch. The other spheres were still there, but the sleeve was unbuttoned. Had she done that? Had they peeked? She couldn't suppress a blush at the thought. The two guards regarded her hungrily. Tevlakov acted humble, but his leering eyes were also very eager. These men were one step from robbing her. But if she left them, she'd probably die out here, alone. Stormfather! What could she do? She felt like sitting down and sobbing. After everything that had happened, now this? Control is the basis of all power. How would Yasna respond to the situation? The answer was simple. She would be Yasna. I will allow you to assist me, Shallan said. She somehow kept her voice even, despite the anxious terror she felt inside.
Brightness?
Tevlakov asked. As you can see, Shallan said, I am the victim of a shipwreck. My servants are lost to me. You and your men will do. I have a trunk. We will need to go fetch it. She felt like one of the 10 fools. Surely he would see through the flimsy act. Pretending you had authority was not the same as having it, no matter what Yasna said.
It would, of course, be our privilege to help,
Tevlakov said.
Brightness.
Tavar, Shallan said, though she took care to soften her voice. Yasna wasn't condescending. Where other light eyes like Shallan's father went about with conceited egotism, Yasna had simply expected people to do as she wished, and they had. She could make this work. She had to. Tradesman Tevlakov, Shallan said, I will need to go to the Shattered Plains. Do you know the way?
The Shattered Plains,
the man asked, glancing at his guards, one of whom had approached.
We were there a few months ago, but are now heading to catch a barge over to Thelena. We have completed our trading in this area with no need to return northward.
Ah, but you do have a need to return, Shallan said, walking toward one of the wagons. Each step was agony. To take me. She glanced around and gratefully noticed Pattern on the side of a wagon, watching. She walked to the front of that wagon, then held out her hand to the other guard who stood nearby. He looked at the hand mutely, scratching his head. Then he looked at the wagon and climbed onto it, reaching down to help her up. Tevlakov walked over to her.
It will be an expensive trip for us to return without wares. I have only these slaves I purchased at the Shallow Crypts. Not enough to justify the trip back. Not yet.
Expensive? Shallan asked, seating herself, trying to project amusement. I assure you, tradesman Tevlakov, the expense is minuscule to me. You will be greatly compensated. Now let us be moving. There are important people waiting for me at the Shattered Plains.
But, Brightness, Tevlakov said, you've obviously had a difficult time of events recently. Yes, that I can see. Let me take you to the Shallow Crypts. It is much closer. You can find rest there, and send word to those waiting for you.
Did I ask to be taken to the shallow crypts?
Bird.
He trailed off as she focused her gaze on him. She softened her expression. I know what I'm doing, and thank you for the advice. Now let us be moving. The three men exchanged befuddled looks, and the slaver took his knit cap off, wringing it in his hands. Nearby, a pair of parshmen with marbled skin walked into camp. Shallan nearly jumped as they trudged by, carrying dried rockbud shells they'd apparently been gathering for fires. Tavlakov gave them no heed. Parshmen. Void bringers. Her skin crawled, but she couldn't worry about them right now. She looked back at the slaver, expecting him to ignore her orders. However, he nodded, and then he and his men simply did as she said. They hitched up the chulls, the slaver got directions to her trunk, and they started moving without further objection. They might just be going along for now, Shallan told herself, because they want to know what's in my trunk. More to rob. But when they reached it, they heaved it onto the wagon, lashed it in place, and then turned around and headed to the north, toward the shattered plains. 12. Hero. Unfortunately, we fixated upon Sadius's plotting so much that we did not take note of the changed pattern of our enemies, the murderers of my husband, the true danger. I would like to know what wind brought about their sudden, inexplicable transformation. From the Journal of Navani Kolin, Yesesach, 1174.
Kaladin pressed the stone against the wall of the chasm, and it stuck there. All right, he said, stepping back. Rock jumped up and grabbed it, then dangled from the wall, bending legs below. His deep, bellowing laugh echoed in the chasm.
This time, he holds me!
Sigzil made a notation on his ledger. Good. Keep hanging on, Rock.
For how long?
Rock asked. Until you fall.
Until I...
The large horn eater frowned, hanging from the stone with both hands.
I do not like this experiment any longer.
Oh, don't whine, Kaladin said, folding his arms and leaning on the wall beside Rock. Spheres lit the chasm floor around them, with its vines, debris, and blooming plants. You're not dropping far.
It is not the drop, Rock complained. It is my arms. I am big man, you see.
So it's a good thing you have big arms to hold you.
It does not work that way, I think, Rock said, grunting. And a handhold is not good, and I...
The stone popped free, and Rock fell downward. Kaladin grabbed his arm, steadying him as he caught himself.
20 seconds, Sigzil said. Not very long.
I warned you, Kaladin said, picking up the fallen stone. It lasts longer if I use more stormlight.
I think we need a baseline, Sigzil said.
He fished in his pocket and pulled out a glowing diamond chip, the smallest denomination of sphere.
Take all of the stormlight from this. Put it into the stone. Then we'll hang Rock from that and see how long he takes to fall.
Rock groaned.
My poor arms.
Hey, Mancha, Lopin called from farther down the chasm. At least you've got two of them, eh?
The Herdasian was watching to make sure none of the new recruits somehow wandered over and saw what Kaladin was doing. It shouldn't happen, they were practicing several chasms over, but Kaladin wanted someone on guard.
Eventually they'll all know anyway, Kaladin thought, taking the chip from Sigzil. Isn't that what you promised, Syl? That you'd let yourself become a Radiant?
Kaladin drew in the chip's stormlight with a sharp intake of breath, then infused the light into the stone. He was getting better at that, drawing the stormlight into his hand, then using it like luminescent paint to coat the bottom of the rock. The stormlight soaked into the stone, and when he pressed it against the wall, it stayed there. Smoky tendrils of luminescence rose from the stone. We probably don't need to make rock hang from it, Kaladin said. If you need a baseline, why not just use how long the stone remains there on its own?
Well, that's less fun, Sigzil said, but very well.
He continued to write numbers on his ledger. That would have made most of the other bridgemen uncomfortable. A man writing was seen as unmasculine, even blasphemous, though Sigzil was only writing glyphs. Today, fortunately, Kaladin had with him Sigzil, Rock, and Lopin, all foreigners from places with different rules. Herdaz was Vorin, technically, but they had their own brand of it, and Lopin didn't seem to mind a man riding.
So, Rock said as they waited, Storm-blessed leader, you said there was something else you could do, did you not?
Fly,
Lopin said from down the passage. I can't fly, Kaladin said dryly.
Walk on walls.
I tried that, Kaladin said. I nearly broke my head from the fall.
Ah, Goncho, Lopin said. No flying or walking on walls. I need to impress the women. I do not think sticking rocks to walls will be enough.
I think anyone would find that impressive, Sigzil said. It defies the laws of nature.
You do not know many Herdazian women, do you? Lopin asked, sighing. Really? I think we should try again on the flying. It will be the best.
There is something more, Kaladin said. Not flying, but still useful. I'm not certain I can replicate it. I've never done it consciously.
The shield,
Rock said, standing by the wall, staring up at the rock.
On the battlefield, when the Parshendi shot at us, the arrows hit your shield. All the arrows.
Yes, Kaladin said.
We should test that, Sigzil said. We'll need a bow.
Spren, Rock said, pointing. They pulled the stone against the wall.
What? Sigzil said, scrambling over, squinting at the rock Kaladin had pressed against the wall.
I don't see them.
Ah, Rock said. Then they do not wish to be seen.
He bowed his head toward them.
Apologies, Mafaliki.
Sigzil frowned, looking closer, holding up a sphere to light the area. Kaladin walked over and joined them. He could make out the tiny purple spren if he looked closely.
They're there, Sig, Kaladin said. Then why can't I see them?
It has to do with my abilities, Kaladin said, glancing at Syl, who sat on a cleft in the rock nearby, one leg draping over and swinging.
But Rock...
I am Maliku,
Rock said, raising a hand to his breast.
Which means?
Sigzil asked impatiently.
That I can see these spren and you cannot.
Rock rested a hand on the smaller man's shoulder.
It's all right, friend. I do not blame you for being blind. Most lowlanders are. It is the air, you see, makes your brains stop working right.
Sigzil frowned, but wrote down some notes while absently doing something with his fingers. Keeping track of the seconds? The rock finally popped off the wall, trailing a few final wisps of stormlight as it hit the ground.
Well over a minute, Sigzil said. I counted 87 seconds.
He looked to the rest of them. We were supposed to be counting? Kaladin asked, glancing at Rock, who shrugged. Sigzil sighed.
91 seconds, Lopin called. You're welcome.
Sigzil sat down on a rock, ignoring a few finger bones peeking out of the moss beside him, and made some notations on his ledger. He scowled.
Ha!
Rock said, squatting down beside him.
You look like you have eaten bad eggs. What is problem?
I don't know what I'm doing, Rock, Sigzil said. My master taught me to ask questions and find precise answers. But how can I be precise? I would need a clock for the timing, but they are too expensive. Even if we had one, I don't know how to measure stormlight.
With chips, Kaladin said. The gemstones are precisely weighed before being encased in glass.
And can they all hold the same amount? Sigzil asked. We know that uncut gems hold less than cut ones. So is one that was cut better going to hold more? Plus, stormlight fades from a sphere over time. How many days has it been since that chip was infused, and how much light has it lost since then? Do they all lose the same amount at the same time? We know too little. I think perhaps I am wasting your time, sir.
It's not a waste, Lopin said, joining them.
The one-armed Hardasian yawned, sitting down on the rock by Sigzil, forcing the other man over a little.
We just need to be testing other things, eh?
Like what? Kaladin said.
Well, Goncho, Lopin said, can you stick me to the wall?
I don't know, Kaladin said.
Seems like it would be good to know, eh?
Lopin stood up.
Shall we try?
Kaladin glanced at Sigzil, who shrugged. Kaladin drew in more stormlight. The raging tempest filled him, as if it were battering against his skin, a captive trying to find a way out. He drew the stormlight into his hand and pressed it against the wall, painting the stones with luminescence. Taking a deep breath, he picked up Lopin. The slender man was startlingly easy to lift, particularly with a measure of stormlight still inside Kaladin's veins. He pressed Lopin against the wall. When Kaladin dubiously stepped back, the Hardasian remained there, stuck to the stone by his uniform, which bunched up under his armpits. Lopin grinned.
It worked!
This thing could be useful, Rock said,
rubbing at his strangely cut horn-eater beard.
Yes, this is what we need to test. You are a soldier, Kaladin. Can you use this in combat?
Kaladin nodded slowly, a dozen possibilities popping into his head. What if his enemies ran across a pool of light he had put on the floor? Could he stop a wagon from rolling? Stick his spear to an enemy shield, then yank it from their hands?
How does it feel, Lopin? Rock asked. Does this thing hurt?
Nah, Lopin said, wiggling. I'm worried my coat will rip, or the buttons will snap. Oh, question for you. What did the one-armed Hardasian do to the man who stuck him to the wall?
Kaladin frowned.
I don't know. Nothing, Lopin said. The Hardasian was armless.
The slender man burst into laughter. Sigzil groaned, though Rock laughed. Syl had cocked her head, zipping over to Kaladin.
Was that a joke? She asked softly.
Yes, Kaladin said. A distinctly bad one.
Ah, don't say that, Lopin said, still chuckling. It's the best one I know. And trust me, I'm an expert on one-armed Hardasian jokes. Lopin, my mother always says, you must learn these to laugh before others do. Then you steal the laughter from them, and have it all for yourself. She is a very wise woman. I once brought her the head of a chol.
Kaladin blinked.
You... what?
Chol head, Lopin said. Very good to eat.
You are a strange man, Lopin, Kaladin said.
No, Rock said. They really are good. The head, he is best part of chol.
I will trust you two on that, Kaladin said. Marginally. He reached up, taking Lopin by the arm as the stormlight holding him in place began to fade. Rock grabbed the man's waist, and they helped him down. All right, Kaladin said, instinctively checking the sky for the time, though he couldn't see the sun through the narrow chasm opening above. Let's experiment. Tempest stoked within him, Kaladin dashed across the chasm floor. His movement startled a group of frill blooms, which pulled in frantically like hands closing. Vines trembled on the walls and began to curl upward. Kaladin's feet splashed in stagnant water. He leaped over a mound of debris, trailing stormlight. He was filled with it, pounding with it. That made it easier to use. It wanted to flow. He pushed it into his spear. Ahead, Lopin, Rock, and Sigzil waited with practice spears. Though Lopin wasn't very good, the missing arm was a huge disadvantage. Rock made up for it. The large horn-eater would not fight Parshendi and would not kill, but had agreed to spar today in the name of experimentation. He fought very well, and Sigzil was acceptable with the spear. Together on the battlefield, the three bridgemen might once have given Kaladin trouble. Times changed. Kaladin tossed his spear sideways at Rock, surprising the Horn Eater, who had raised his weapon to block. The stormlight made Kaladin's spear stick to Rock's, forming a cross. Rock cursed, trying to turn his spear around to strike, but in doing so, smacked himself on the side with Kaladin's spear. As Lopin's spear struck, Kaladin pushed it down easily with one hand, filling the tip with stormlight. The weapon hit the pile of refuse and stuck to the wooden bones. Sigzil's weapon came in, missing Kaladin's chest by a wide margin as he stepped aside. Kaladin nudged and infused the weapon with the flat of his hand, shoving it into Lopin's, which he'd just pulled out of the refuse, plastered with moss and bone. The two spears stuck together. Kaladin slipped between Rock and Sigzil, leaving the three of them in a jumbled mess, off balance and trying to disentangle their weapons. Kaladin smiled grimly, jogging down to the other end of the chasm. He picked up a spear, then turned, dancing from one foot to the other. The stormlight encouraged him to move. Standing still was practically impossible while holding so much. "Come on, come on," he thought. The three others finally got their weapons apart as the stormlight ran out. They formed up to face him again. Kaladin dashed forward. In the dim light of the chasm, the glow of the smoke rising from him was strong enough to cast shadows that leaped and spun. He crashed through pools, the water cold on his unshod feet. He'd removed his boots. He wanted to feel the stone underneath him. This time, the three bridgemen set the butts of their spears on the ground, as if against a charge. Kaladin smiled, then grabbed the top of his spear, like theirs it was a practice one without a real spearhead, and infused it with stormlight. He slapped it against Rock's, intending to yank it out of the Horn Eater's hands. Rock had other plans and hauled his spear back with a strength that took Kaladin by surprise. He nearly lost his grip. Lopin and Sigzil quickly moved to come at him from either side. "Nice," Kaladin thought, proud. He'd taught them formations like that, showing them how to work together on the battlefield. As they drew close, Kaladin let go of his spear and stuck out his leg. The stormlight flowed out of his bare foot as easily as it did his hands, and he was able to swipe a large, glowing arc on the ground. Sigzil stepped in it and tripped, his foot sticking to the light. He tried to stab as he fell, but there was no force behind the blow. Kaladin slammed his weight against Lopin, whose strike was off-center. He shoved Lopin against the wall, then pulled back, leaving the Herdasian stuck to the stone, which Kaladin had infused in the heartbeat they'd been pressed together.
"Oh, not again," Lopin said with a groan.
Sigzil had fallen face first in the water. Kaladin barely had time to smile before he noticed Rock swinging a log at his head. An entire log. How had Rock lifted that thing? Kaladin threw himself out of the way, rolling on the ground and scraping his hand as the log crashed against the floor of the chasm. Kaladin growled, stormlight passing between his teeth and rising into the air in front of him. He jumped onto Rock's log as the Horn Eater tried to lift it again. Kaladin's landing slammed the wood back against the ground. He leaped toward Rock, and part of him wondered just what he was thinking, getting into a hand-to-hand fight with someone twice his weight. He slammed into the Horn Eater, hurling them both to the ground. They rolled in the moss, Rock twisting to pin Kaladin's arms. The Horn Eater obviously had training as a wrestler. Kaladin poured stormlight into the ground. It wouldn't affect or hamper him, he'd found. So, as they rolled, first Rock's arm stuck to the ground, then his side. The Horn Eater kept fighting to get Kaladin into a hold. He almost had it, till Kaladin pushed with his legs, rolling both of them so Rock's other elbow touched the ground where it stuck. Kaladin tore away, gasping and puffing, losing most of his remaining stormlight as he coughed. He leaned up against the wall, mopping sweat from his face.
"Ha!"
Rock said, stuck to the ground, splayed with arms to the sides.
"I almost had you. Slippery as a fifth son you are."
"Storms, Rock," Kaladin said. "What I wouldn't do to get you on the battlefield. You're wasted as a cook."
"You don't like my food?" Rock asked, laughing. "I will have to try something with more grease. This thing will fit you. Grabbing you was like trying to keep my hands on a live lake fish. One that has been covered in butter, ha!"
Kaladin stepped up to him, squatting down.
"You're a warrior, Rock. I saw it in Teft, and you can say whatever you want, but I see it in you.
I am wrong son to be soldier, Rock said stubbornly. It is a thing of the Tuana Lekina, the fourth son or below. Third son cannot be wasted in battle.
Didn't stop you from throwing a tree at my head.
Was small tree, Rock said, and very hard head.
Kaladin smiled, then reached down, touching the stormlight infused into the stone beneath Rock. He hadn't ever tried to take it back after using it in this way. Could he? He closed his eyes and breathed in, trying. Yes. Some of the tempest within him stoked again. When he opened his eyes, Rock was free. Kaladin hadn't been able to take it all back, but some. The rest was evaporating into the air. He took Rock by the hand, helping the larger man to his feet. Rock dusted himself off.
That was embarrassing, Sigzil said as Kaladin walked over to free him, too. It's like we're children. The Prime's own eyes have not seen such a shameful show.
I have a very unfair advantage, Kaladin said, helping Sigzil to his feet. Years of training as a soldier, a larger build than you. Oh, and the ability to emit stormlight from my fingers. He patted Sigzil on the shoulder. You did well. This is just a test, like you wanted.
A more useful type of test, Kaladin thought.
Sure, Lopin said from behind them. Just go ahead and leave the hair daisy and stuck to the wall. The view here is wonderful. Oh, and is that slime running down my cheek? A fresh new look for the Lopin who cannot brush it away because, have I mentioned, his hand is stuck to the wall?
Kaladin smiled, walking over. You were the one who asked me to stick you to a wall in the first place, Lopin.
My other hand, Lopin said. The one that was cut off long ago, eaten by a fearsome beast. It is making a rude gesture toward you right now. I thought you would wish to know so that you can prepare to be insulted.
He said it with the same lightheartedness with which he seemed to approach everything. He had even joined the bridge crew with a certain crazy eagerness. Kaladin let him down.
This thing, Rock said. It worked well.
Yes, Kaladin said. Though honestly, he probably could have dispatched the three men more easily just by using a spear and the extra speed and strength the stormlight lent. He didn't know yet whether that was because he was unfamiliar with these new powers, but he did think that forcing himself to use them had put him in some awkward positions.
Familiarity, he thought. I need to know these abilities as well as I know my spear.
That meant practice. Lots of practice. Unfortunately, the best way to practice was to find someone who matched or bested you in skill, strength, and capacity. Considering what he could now do, that was going to be a tall order. The three others walked over to dig water skins from their packs, and Kaladin noticed a figure standing in the shadows a little ways down the chasm. Kaladin stood up, alarmed until Teft emerged in the light of their spheres.
I thought you were going to be on watch, Teft growled at Lopin.
Too busy being stuck to walls, Lopin said, raising his water skin. I thought you had a bunch of green vines to train.
Drey has them in hand, Teft said,
picking his way around some debris, joining Kaladin beside the chasm wall.
I don't know if the lads told you, Kaladin, but bringing that lot down here broke them out of their shells somehow.
Kaladin nodded.
How did you get to know people so well? Teft asked.
It involves a lot of cutting them apart, Kaladin said, looking down at his hand, which he'd scraped while fighting Rock. The scrape was gone, Stormlight having healed the tears in his skin. Teft grunted, glancing back at Rock and the other two, who had broken out rations.
You ought to put Rock in charge of the new recruits.
He won't fight.
He just sparred with you, Teft said. So maybe he will with them. People like him more than me. I'm just going to screw this up.
You'll do a fine job, Teft. I won't have you saying otherwise. We have resources now. No more scrimping for every last sphere. You'll train those lads and you'll do it right.
Teft sighed, but said no more.
You saw what I did?
Aye, Teft said. We'll need to bring down the entire group of 20 if we want to give you a proper challenge.
That or find another person like myself, Kaladin said. Someone to spar with.
Aye,
Teft said again, nodding as if he hadn't considered that. There were 10 orders of knights, right? Kaladin asked. Do you know much of the others? Teft had been the first one to figure out what Kaladin could do. He'd known before Kaladin himself had.
Not much, Teft said with a grimace. I know the orders didn't always get along, despite what the official stories say. We'll need to see if we can find someone who knows more than I do. I kept away. And the people I knew who could tell us, they aren't around any longer.
If Teft had been in a dour mood before, this drove him down even further. He looked at the ground. He spoke of his past infrequently, but Kaladin was more and more certain that whoever these people had been, they were dead because of something Teft himself had done.
What would you think if you heard that somebody wanted to refound the Knights Radiant?
Kaladin said softly to Teft. Teft looked up sharply.
You?
Not me,
Kaladin said, speaking carefully. Dalinar Kolin had let him listen in on the conference, and while Kaladin trusted Teft, there were certain expectations of silence that an officer was required to uphold.
Dalinar is a light eyes, part of him whispered. He wouldn't think twice if he were revealing a secret you'd shared with him.
Not me, Kaladin repeated.
What if a king somewhere decided he wanted to gather a group of people and name them Knights Radiant?
I'd call him an idiot, Teft said. Now, the Radiants weren't what people say. They weren't traitors. They just weren't. But everyone is sure they betrayed us, and you're not going to change minds quickly. Not unless you can surge bind to quiet them.
Teft looked Kaladin up and down.
Are you going to do it, lad?
They'd hate me, wouldn't they? Kaladin said.
He couldn't help noticing Syl, who walked through the air until she was close, studying him.
For what the old Radiants did.
He held up a hand to stop Teft's objection.
What people think they did.
Aye, Teft said.
Syl folded her arms, giving Kaladin a look.
You promised, that look said. We'll have to be careful about how we do it, then, Kaladin said.
Go gather the new recruits. They've had enough practice down here for one day. Teft nodded, then jogged off to do as ordered. Kaladin gathered his spear and the spheres he'd set out to light the sparring, then waved to the other three. They packed up their things and began the hike back out.
So you're going to do it, Syl said, landing on his shoulder.
I want to practice more first, Kaladin said.
And get used to the idea. It will be fine, Kaladin.
No, it will be hard. People will hate me, and even if they don't, I'll be set apart from them. Separated. I've accepted that as my lot, though. I'll deal with it.
Even in Bridge 4, Moash was the only one who didn't treat Kaladin like some mythological savior herald. Him, and maybe Rock. Still, the other bridgemen hadn't reacted with the fear he'd once worried about. They might idolize him, but they did not isolate him. It was good enough. They reached the rope ladder before Teft and the Greenbinds, but there was no reason to wait. Kaladin climbed up out of the muggy chasm onto the plateau just east of the war camps. It felt so strange to be able to carry his spear and money out of the chasm. Indeed, the soldiers guarding the approach to Dalinar's war camp didn't pester him. Instead, they saluted and stood up straight. It was as crisp a salute as he'd ever gotten, as crisp as the ones given to a general.
They seem proud of you, Syl said. They don't even know you, but they're proud of you.
They're dark eyes, Kaladin said, saluting back.
Probably men who were fighting on the tower when Sadeas betrayed them.
Stormblessed, one of them called. Have you heard the news?
Curse the one who told them that nickname,
Kaladin thought, as Rock and the other two caught up to him.
No,
Kaladin called.
What news? A hero has come to the Shattered Plains,
the soldier yelled back.
He's going to meet with Bright Lord Kolin. Perhaps support him. It's a good sign. Might help calm things down around here.
What's this? Rock called back.
Who?
The soldier said a name. Kaladin's heart became ice. He nearly lost his spear from numb fingers, and then he took off running. He didn't heed Rock's cry behind him, didn't stop to let the others catch up with him. He dashed through the camp, running toward Dalinar's command complex at its center. He didn't want to believe when he saw the banner hanging in the air above a group of soldiers, probably matched by a much larger group outside the war camp. Kaladin passed them, drawing cries and stares, questions if something was wrong. He finally stumbled to a stop outside the short set of steps into Dalinar's bunkered complex of stone buildings. There, standing in front, the Blackthorn clasped hands with a tall man. Square-faced and dignified, the newcomer wore a pristine uniform. He laughed, then embraced Dalinar.
"Old friend," he said, "it's been too long."
"Too long by far," Dalinar agreed. "I'm glad you finally made your way here after years of promises. I've heard you've even found yourself a shard blade."
"Yes,"
the newcomer said, pulling back and holding his hand to the side.
"Taken from an assassin who dared try to kill me on the field of battle."
The blade appeared. Kaladin stared at the silvery weapon. Etched along its length, the blade was shaped to look like flames in motion, and to Kaladin it seemed that the weapon was stained red. Names flooded his mind. Dalet, Korib, Rish, a squad before time, from another life. Men Kaladin had loved. He looked up and forced himself to see the face of the newcomer. A man Kaladin hated. Hated beyond any other. A man he had once worshipped. High Lord Amaram. The man who had stolen Kaladin's shard blade, branded his forehead, and sold him into slavery. The end of part one.
Interludes. Eshonai, Yim, Rissen. I-1. Narak. The rhythm of resolve thrummed softly in the back of Eshonai's mind as she reached the plateau at the center of the shattered plains. The central plateau. Narak. Exile. Home. She ripped the helm of the shard plate from her head, taking a deep breath of cool air. Plate ventilated wonderfully, but even it grew stuffy after extended exertions. Other soldiers landed behind her. She had taken some 1,500 this run. Fortunately, this time they'd arrived well before the humans and had harvested the gem heart with minimal fighting. Devi carried it. He had earned the privilege by being the one to spot the chrysalis from afar. Almost, she wished it had not been so easy a run. Almost. "Where are you, Blackthorn?" she thought, looking westward. "Why have you not come to face me again?" She thought she'd seen him on that run a week or so back, when they'd been forced off the plateau by his son. Eshonai had not participated in that fight. Her wounded leg ached, and the jumping from plateau to plateau had stressed it, even in shard plate. Perhaps she should not be going on these runs in the first place. She'd wanted to be there in case her strike force grew surrounded and needed a shard bearer, even a wounded one, to break them free. Her leg still hurt, but plate cushioned it enough. Soon she would have to return to the fighting. Perhaps if she participated directly, the Blackthorn would appear again. She needed to speak with him. She felt an urgency to do so, blowing upon the winds themselves. Her soldiers raised hands in farewell as they went their separate ways. Many softly sang or hummed a song to the rhythm of mourning. These days, few sang to excitement, or even to resolve. Step by step, storm by storm, depression claimed her people. The listeners, as they called their race. Parshendi was a human term. Eshonai strode toward the ruins that dominated Narak. After so many years, there wasn't much left. Ruins of ruins, one might call them. The works of men and listeners alike did not last long before the might of the high storms. That stone spire ahead, that had probably once been a tower. Over the centuries, it had grown a thick coating of creme from the raging storms. The soft creme had seeped into cracks and filled windows, then slowly hardened. The tower now looked like an enormous stalagmite, rounded point toward the sky, side knobbed with rock that looked as if it had been melted. The spire must have had a strong core to survive the winds so long. Other examples of ancient engineering had not fared so well. Eshonai passed lumps and mounds, remnants of fallen buildings that had slowly been consumed by the shattered plains. The storms were unpredictable. Sometimes huge sections of rock would break free from formations, leaving gouges and jagged edges. Other times, spires would stand for centuries, growing, not shrinking, as the winds both weathered and augmented them. Eshonai had discovered similar ruins in her explorations, such as the one she'd been on when her people had first encountered humans, only 7 years ago, but also an eternity. She had loved those days, exploring a wide world that felt infinite. And now? Now she spent her life trapped on this one plateau. The wilderness called to her, sang that she should gather up what things she could carry and strike out. Unfortunately, that was no longer her destiny. She passed into the shadow of a big lump of rock that she always imagined might have been a city gate. From what little they'd learned from their spies over the years, she knew that the Alethi did not understand. They marched over the uneven surface of the plateaus and saw only natural rock, never knowing that they traversed the bones of a city long dead. Eshonai shivered and attuned the rhythm of the lost. It was a soft beat, yet still violent, with sharp, separated notes. She did not attune it for long. Remembering the fallen was important, but working to protect the living was more so. She attuned resolve again and entered Narak. Here, the listeners had built the best home they could during the years of war. Rocky shelves had become barracks, carapace from great shelves forming the walls and roofs. Mounds that had once been buildings now grew rock buds for food on their leeward sides. Much of the shattered plains had once been populated, but the largest city had been here at the center. So now the ruins of her people made their home in the ruins of a dead city. They had named it Narak, exile, for it was where they had come to be separated from their gods. Listeners, both Malin and Femalin, raised hands to her as she passed. So few remained. The humans were relentless in their pursuit of vengeance. She didn't blame them. She turned toward the Hall of Art. It was nearby, and she hadn't put in an appearance there for days. Inside, soldiers did a laughable job of painting. Eshonai strode among them, still wearing her shard plate, helm under her arm. The long building had no roof, allowing in plenty of light to paint by, and the walls were thick with long-hardened creme. Holding thick bristled brushes, the soldiers tried their best to depict the arrangement of rockbud flowers on a pedestal at the center. Eshonai did a round of the artists, looking at their work. Paper was precious and canvas non-existent, so they painted on shell. The paintings were awful. Splotches of garish color, off-center petals. Eshonai paused beside Varanis, one of her lieutenants. He held the brush delicately between armored fingers, a hulking form before an easel. Plates of chitin armor grew from his arms, shoulders, chest, even head. They were matched by her own, under her plate. "You are getting better," Eshonai said to him, speaking to the rhythm of praise. He looked to her and hummed softly to skepticism. Eshenai chuckled, resting a hand on his shoulder. It actually looks like flowers, Varanus. I mean it.
It looks like muddy water on a brown plateau, he said. Maybe with some brown leaves floating in it. Why do colors turn brown when they mix? Three beautiful colors put together and they become the least beautiful color. It makes no sense, General.
General. At times, she felt as awkward in the position as these men did trying to paint pictures. She wore war form, as she needed the armor for battle, but she preferred work form. More limber, more rugged. It wasn't that she disliked leading these men, but doing the same thing every day, drills, plateau runs, numbed her mind. She wanted to be seeing new things, going new places. Instead, she joined her people in a long funeral vigil, as one by one they died. No, we will find a way out of it. The art was part of that, she hoped. By her order, each man or woman took a turn in the Hall of Art at their appointed time. And they tried. They tried hard. So far, it had been about as successful as trying to leap a chasm with the other side out of sight. No Spren? She asked.
Not a one.
He said it to the rhythm of mourning. She heard that rhythm far too often these days. Keep trying, she said. We will not lose this battle for lack of effort.
But General, Varanus said, what is the point? Having artists won't save us from the swords of humans.
Nearby, other soldiers turned to hear her answer.
Artists won't help, she said to the rhythm of peace. But my sister is confident that she is close to discovering new forms. If we can discover how to create artists, then it might teach her more about the process of change, and that might help her with her research, help her discover forms stronger even than war form. Artists won't get us out of this, but some other form might.
Varanus nodded. He was a good soldier. Not all of them were. War form did not intrinsically make one more disciplined. Unfortunately, it did hamper one's artistic skill. Eshenai had tried painting. She couldn't think the right way, couldn't grasp the abstraction needed to create art. War form was a good form, versatile. It didn't impede thought like mate form did. As with work form, you were yourself when you were war form, but each had its quirks. A worker had difficulty committing violence. There was a block in the mind somewhere. That was one of the reasons she liked the form. It forced her to think differently to get around problems. Neither form could create art. Not well, at least. Mate form was better, but came with a whole host of other problems. Keeping those types focused on anything productive was almost impossible. There were two other forms, though the first, dull form, was one they rarely used. It was a relic of the past, before they'd rediscovered something better. That left only nimble form, a general form that was lithe and careful. They used it for nurturing young and doing the kind of work that required more dexterity than brawn. Few could be spared for that form, though it was more skilled at art. The old songs spoke of hundreds of forms. Now they knew of only five. Well, six, if one counted slave form. The form with no spren, no soul, and no song. The form the humans were accustomed to. The ones they called parshmen. It wasn't really a form at all, however, but a lack of any form. Eshenai left the Hall of Art, helm under her arm, leg aching. She passed through the watering square, where Nimbles had crafted a large pool from sculpted creme. It caught rain during the riddens of a storm, thick with nourishment. Here, workers carried buckets to fetch water. Their forms were strong, almost like that of war form, though with thinner fingers and no armor. Many nodded to her, though as a general she had no authority over them.
She was their last shard-bearer. A group of three mate forms, two female, one male, played in the water, splashing at one another. Barely clothed, they dripped with what others would be drinking.
You three,
Eshonai snapped at them. Shouldn't you be doing something? Plump and vapid, they grinned at Eshonai. Come in, one called. It's fun. Out, Eshonai said, pointing. The three muttered to the rhythm of irritation as they climbed from the water. Nearby, several workers shook their heads as they passed, one singing to praise in appreciation of Eshonai. Workers did not like confrontation. It was an excuse. Just as those who took on mate form use their form as an excuse for their inane activities. When a worker, Eshonai had trained herself to confront when necessary. She'd even been a mate once, and had proven to herself firsthand that one could indeed be productive as a mate, despite distractions. Of course, the rest of her experiences as a mate had been an utter disaster. She spoke to reprimand to the mate forms, her words so passionate that she actually attracted anger spren. She saw them coming from a ways off, drawn by her emotion, moving with an incredible speed, like lightning dancing toward her across the distant stone. The lightning pooled at her feet, turning the stones red. That put the fear of the gods into the mate forms, and they ran off to report to the Hall of Art. Hopefully they wouldn't end up in an alcove along the way, mating. Her stomach churned at the thought. She had never been able to fathom people who wanted to remain in mate form. Most couples, in order to have a child, would enter the form and sequester themselves away for a year, then would be out of the form as soon after the child's birth as possible. After all, who would want to go out in public like that? The humans did it. That had baffled her during those early days, when she'd spent time learning their language, trading with them. Not only did humans not change forms, they were always ready to mate, always distracted by sexual urges. What she wouldn't have given to be able to go among them unnoticed, to adopt their monochrome skin for a year and walk their highways, see their grand cities. Instead, she and the others had ordered the murder of the Alethi king in a desperate gambit to stop the listener gods from returning. Well, that had worked. The Alethi king hadn't been able to put his plan into action, but now her people were slowly being destroyed as a result. She finally reached the rock formation she called home, a small, collapsed dome. It reminded her of the ones on the edge of the shattered plains, actually, the enormous ones that the humans called war camps. Her people had lived in those, before abandoning them for the security of the shattered plains, with its chasms the humans couldn't jump. Her home was much, much smaller, of course. During the early days of living here, Venli had crafted a roof of great shell carapace and built walls to divide the space into chambers. She'd covered it all over with creme, which had hardened with time, creating something that actually felt like a home instead of a shanty. Eshonai set her helm on a table just inside, but left the rest of her armor on. Shard plate just felt right to her. She liked the sensation of strength. It let her know that something was still reliable in the world, and with the power of shard plate she could mostly ignore the wound to her leg. She ducked through a few rooms, nodding to the people she passed. Venli's associates were scholars, though no one knew the proper form for true scholarship. Nimble form was their makeshift substitute for now. Eshonai found her sister beside the window of the farthest chamber. Demid, Venli's once mate, sat next to her. Venli had held nimble form for 3 years, as long as they'd known of the form. Though in Eshonai's mind's eye, she still saw her sister as a worker, with thicker arms and a stouter torso. That was the past. Now Venli was a slender woman with a thin face, her
her marbling's delicate swirling patterns of red and white. Nimble form grew long hair strands, with no carapace helm to block them. Venli's, a deep red, flowed down to her waist, where they were tied in three places. She wore a robe, drawn tight at the waist and showing a hint of breasts at the chest. This was not mate form, so they were small. Venli and her once mate were close, though their time as mates had produced no children. If they'd gone to the battlefield, they'd have been a war pair. Instead, they were a research pair or something. The things they spent their days doing were very unlistener. That was the point. Eshonai's people could not afford to be what they had been in the past. The days of lounging isolated on these plateaus, singing songs to one another, only occasionally fighting, were over. "So?" Venli asked curiosity. "We won," Eshonai said, leaning back against the wall and folding her arms with a clink of shard plate. "The gem heart is ours. We will continue to eat."
"That is well," Venli said. "And you're human?"
"Dalinar Kolin. He did not come to this battle."
"He will not face you again," Venli said. "You nearly killed him last time."
She said it to the rhythm of amusement as she rose, picking up a piece of paper. They made it from dried rockbud pulp following a harvest, which she handed to her once mate. Looking it over, he nodded and began making notes on his own sheet. That paper required precious time and resources to make, but Venli insisted the reward would be worth the effort. She'd better be right. Venli regarded Eshonai. She had keen eyes, glassy and dark, like those of all listeners. Venli's always seemed to have an extra depth of secret knowledge to them. In the right light, they had a violet cast.
"What would you do, sister?" Venli asked.
"If you and this Kolin were actually able to stop trying to kill each other long enough to have a conversation?"
"I'd sue for peace."
"We murdered his brother," Venli said. "We slaughtered King Gavilar on a night when he'd invited us into his home. That is not something the Alethi will forget or forgive." Eshonai unfolded her arms and flexed a gauntleted hand. "That night, a desperate plan made between herself and five others. She had been part of it despite her youth because of her knowledge of the humans. All had voted the same. Kill the man. Kill him and risk destruction. For if he had lived to do what he told them that night, all would have been lost. The others who had made that decision with her were dead now."
"I have discovered the secret of storm form," Venli said.
"What?"
Eshonai stood up straight.
"You were to be working on a form to help. A form for diplomats, or for scholars."
"Those will not save us," Venli said to amusement. "If we wish to deal with the humans, we will need the ancient powers."
"Venli," Eshonai said, grabbing her sister by the arm. "Our gods!"
Venli didn't flinch.
"The humans have surge binders."
"Perhaps not. It could have been an honor blade."
"You fought him. Was it an honor blade that struck you, wounded your leg, sent you limping?"
Her leg ached.
"We don't know which of the songs are true," Venli said.
Though she said it to resolve, she sounded tired, and she drew exhaustion spren. They came with a sound like wind, blowing in through the windows and doors like jets of translucent vapor, before becoming stronger, more visible, and spinning around her head like swirls of steam.
"My poor sister. She works herself as hard as the soldiers do."
"If the surge binders have returned," Venli continued, "we must strive for something meaningful, something that can ensure our freedom. The forms of power, Eshonai." She glanced at Eshonai's hand, still on her arm.
At least sit and listen, and stop looming like a mountain. Eshonai removed her fingers but did not sit. Her shard plate's weight would break a chair. Instead, she leaned forward, inspecting the table full of papers. Venli had invented the script herself. They'd learned that concept from the humans. Memorizing songs was good, but not perfect, even when you had the rhythms to guide you. Information stored on pages was more practical, especially for research. Eshonai had taught herself the script, but reading was still difficult for her. She did not have much time to practice. So, storm form? Eshonai said. Enough people of that form, Fenley said, could control a high storm, or even summon one. I remember the song that speaks of this form, Eshonai said. It was a thing of the gods. Most of the forms are related to them in some way, Venli said. Can we really trust the accuracy of words first sung so long ago? When those songs were memorized, our people were mostly dull form. It was a form of low intelligence, low capacity. They used it now to spy on the humans. Once, it and mate form had been the only forms her people had known. Demid shuffled some of the pages, moving a stack. Vanley is right, Eshonai. This is a risk we must take. We could negotiate with the Alethi, Eshonai said. To what end? Vanley said, again to skepticism, her exhaustion spren finally fading, the spren spinning away to search out more fresh sources of emotion. Eshonai, you keep saying you want to negotiate. I think it is because you are fascinated by humans. You think they'll let you go freely among them? A person they see as having the form of a rebellious slave?
Centuries ago, Demid said, we escaped both our gods and the humans. Our ancestors left behind civilization, power, and might in order to secure freedom. I would not give that up, Eshonai. Storm form. With it, we can destroy the Alethi army.
With them gone, Venli said, you can return to exploration. No responsibility. You could travel, make your maps, discover places no person has ever seen.
What I want for myself is meaningless, Eshonai said to reprimand, so long as we are all in danger of destruction.
She scanned the specks on the page, scribbles of songs. Songs without music, written out as they were, their souls stripped away. Could the listener's salvation really be in something so terrible? Venli and her team had spent 5 years recording all of the songs, learning the nuances from the elderly, capturing them in these pages. Through collaboration, research, and deep thought, they had discovered Nimbleform. It is the only way, Venli said to Peace. We will bring this to the Five, Eshonai. I would have you on our side.
I will consider.
I too. Yim. Yim carefully trimmed the wood from the side of the small block. He held it up to the sphere light beside his bench, pinching his spectacles by the rim and holding them closer to his eyes. Such delightful inventions, spectacles. To live was to be a fragment of the Cosmere that was experiencing itself. How could he properly experience if he couldn't see? The Azish man who had first created these devices was long deceased, and Yim had submitted a proposal that he be considered one of the honored dead. Yim lowered the piece of wood and continued to carve it, carefully whittling off the front to form a curve. Some of his colleagues bought their lasts, the wooden forms around which a cobbler built his shoes, from carpenters. But Yim had been taught to make his own. That was the old way, the way it had been done for centuries. If something had been done one way for such a long time, he figured there was probably a good reason. Behind him stood the shadowed cubbies of a cobbler's shop, the toes of dozens of shoes peeking out like the noses of eels in their holes. These were test shoes, used to judge size, choose materials, and decide styles, so he could construct the perfect shoe to fit the foot and character of the individual. A fitting could take quite a while, assuming you did it properly. Something moved in the dimness to his right. Yim glanced in that direction, but didn't change his posture. The spren had been coming more often lately. Specks of light, like those from a piece of crystal suspended in a sunbeam. He did not know its type, as he had never seen one like it before. It moved across the surface of the workbench, slinking closer. When it stopped, light crept upward from it, like small plants growing or climbing from their burrows. When it moved again, those withdrew. Yim returned to his sculpting.
It will be for making a shoe.
The evening shop was quiet, save for the scraping of his knife on wood.
Shoe?
A voice asked, like that of a young woman, soft, with a kind of chiming musicality to it.
Yes, my friend, he said. A shoe for young children. I find myself in need of those more and more these days.
Shoe, the spren said. For children. Little people.
Yim brushed wooden scraps off the bench for later sweeping, then set the last on the bench near the spren. It shied away, like a reflection off a mirror, translucent, really just a shimmer of light. He withdrew his hand and waited. The spren inched forward, tentative, like a kremlin creeping out of its crack after a storm. It stopped, and light grew upward from it in the shape of tiny sprouts. Such an odd sight.
You're an interesting experience, my friend,
Yim said as the shimmer of light moved on to the last itself.
One in which I am honored to participate.
The
spren said. The spren's form shook suddenly, then grew more intense, like light being focused.
He comes.
Yim stood up, suddenly anxious. Something moved on the street outside. Was it that one? The watcher in the military coat? But no, it was just a child, peering in through the open door. Yim smiled, opening his drawer of spheres and letting more light into the room. The child shied back, just as the spren had. The spren had vanished somewhere. It did that when others drew near.
No need to fear,
Yim said, settling back down on his stool.
Come in. Let me get a look at you.
The dirty young urchin peered back in. He wore only a ragged pair of trousers, no shirt, though that was common here in Erie, where both days and nights were usually warm. The poor child's feet were dirty and scraped.
No,
Yim said.
That won't do. Come, young one, settle down. Let's get something on those feet.
He moved out one of his smaller stools.
They say you don't charge nothing, the boy said, not moving.
They are quite wrong,
Yim said.
But I think you will find my cost bearable.
Don't have no spheres.
No spheres are needed. Your payment will be your story. Your experiences. I would hear them.
They said you was strange, the boy said, finally walking into the shop.
They were right,
Yim said, patting the stool. The urchin stepped timidly up to the stool, walking with a limp he tried to hide. He was Erie Alley, though the grime darkened his skin and hair, both of which were golden. The skin less so. You needed the light to see it right, but the hair certainly. It was the mark of their people. Yim motioned for the child to raise his good foot, then got out a washcloth, wetted it, and cleaned away the grime. He wasn't about to do a fitting on feet so dirty. Noticeably, the boy tucked back the foot he'd limped on, as if trying to hide that it had a rag wrapped around it.
"So,"
Yim said,
"your story?"
"You're old," the boy said. "Older than anyone I know. Grandpa old. You must know everything already. What do you want to hear from me?"
"It is one of my quirks,"
Yim said.
"Come now, let's hear it."
The boy huffed, but talked. Briefly. That wasn't uncommon. He wanted to hold his story to himself. Slowly, with careful questions, Yim pried the story free. The boy was the son of a whore, and had been kicked out as soon as he could fend for himself. That had been 3 years ago, the boy thought. He was probably 8 now. As he listened, Yim cleaned the first foot, then clipped and filed the nails. Once done, he motioned for the other foot. The boy reluctantly lifted it up. Yim undid the rag and found a nasty cut on the bottom of that foot. It was already infected, crawling with rotspren, tiny motes of red. Yim hesitated. "You needed to get some shoes," the urchin said, looking the other way. "Can't keep on without 'em." The rip in the skin was jagged.
"Done climbing over a fence, perhaps?"
Yim thought. The boy looked at him, feigning nonchalance. A wound like this would slow an urchin down terribly, which on the streets could easily mean death. Yim knew that all too well. He looked up at the boy, noting the shadow of worry in those little eyes. The infection had spread up the leg.
"My friend,"
Yim whispered,
"I believe I am going to need your help."
"What?" the urchin said.
"Nothing,"
Yim replied, reaching into the drawer of his table. The light spilling out was just from 5 diamond chips. Every urchin who had come to him had seen those. So far, Yim had been robbed of them only 2. He dug more deeply, unfolding a hidden compartment in the drawer and taking a more powerful sphere, a broom.